From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, prime editing. It's a new tool for fixing genes. We'll talk to the lead researcher.
Like many scientists, I've dreamed of a future in which you might be able to treat or maybe even cure human genetic diseases.
Also today, this year's FAFSA application is open, but the process isn't easy.
Colleges want students and families to jump through a burning hoop on fire while blindfolded and backwards.
We'll take your calls on how to get through it. And poet Dwayne Betts on finding poetry in prison.
Once I got locked up, books became the site of magic. It became the way in which I experienced the world. But more importantly, I think it became the way in which I learned about what it means to be human and to be flawed and to want things that you can't have.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. A research team at the Broad Institute, a collaboration between Harvard and MIT, has developed a new tool for making changes to DNA. It's called prime editing. Scientists say it's a major advance on the revolutionary gene editing technology called CRISPR, including potentially allowing us to correct the vast majority of mutations that cause genetic diseases. Prime editing was developed in the lab of David Liu, Richard Merkin professor at the Broad Institute and a chemistry professor at Harvard. Professor Liu joins us from Houston, where he's at a conference on the chemistry of genome editing and imaging. David Liu, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So, David, have mercy on us everyday people and explain in lay terms this innovation that you've developed. How does it work?
So there are many ways that the DNA letters in each of our cells can change that cause genetic diseases. And we developed a system to try to be able to install or correct as many of these changes as possible. And that system, as you mentioned, is called prime editing. Prime editors are made of two key components, an engineered protein and an engineered RNA molecule, that together orchestrate a series of DNA targeting, DNA writing, and DNA repair steps that result in a true search and replace capability for changing DNA sequences.
So basically, you can go in, find something that you want to change, get rid of the bad and put in the good kind of all in one fell swoop?
Yeah, that's right. So you can go into a target site in a vast genome that you specify, and you can directly add new DNA letters one at a time to a target site of DNA of your choosing, and in the process replace the original bases, that the original DNA letters that used to be there.
How is this a breakthrough over previous gene editing technology?
Well, so first I just want to make it clear that I think all of the different types of genome editing technologies have complementary strengths and weaknesses. So I think they'll all find important roles in research and in applications such as human therapeutics or agriculture. The original CRISPR-Cas9 genome editing technology is like a pair of molecular scissors that makes cuts in DNA, breaking the double helix into two pieces. And the most common result of cutting DNA is that the cell makes mixtures of insertions and deletions at the cut site. And that can be quite useful if your goal is to disrupt genes. But if your goal is to make precise DNA changes, it can be difficult to do so by cutting the DNA.
Okay, so
prime editing is an example of a technology that doesn't cut DNA in order to make these kinds of changes. We also developed previously another kind of genome editing technology called base editing, which, like prime editing, does not require DNA cutting and can directly make changes to DNA. Base editors can correct four of the most common kinds of point mutations efficiently while avoiding cutting DNA, but base editing can't make some of the other kinds of changes that we can now make with prime editors.
So, David, there are three different kinds of editing technologies you just talked about, it would be, if I'm understanding you correctly, one would not think of them sort of as 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0, and you get rid of the earlier versions. They're variations that allow you to do different things. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. So you can think of the original CRISPR-Cas9 as scissors. People have likened base editors to pencils. And you can liken prime editors to word processors capable of searching DNA sequences and precisely replacing them. And just as scissors, pencils, and word processors each have unique and useful roles in our everyday life, I would argue that each of these three different technologies you just mentioned will also have complementary and unique roles.
So great. So give us an example of what might now be possible, like a practical, we could fix X when before we couldn't.
So we showed a couple examples in our paper that just published. One example is that Tay-Sachs disease, it's a well-known genetic disease, is most commonly caused by the insertion of four DNA letters at a certain site in one of your genes called hex A. And we used prime editing to precisely remove those four extra DNA letters, restoring the original sequence of the hex A gene.
So that could essentially eliminate Tay-Sachs.
Well, it's one step in an important series of processes that would need to happen in order to use prime editing to try to treat a genetic disease like Tay-Sachs. But it's important to emphasize that in addition to making the desired change, which is certainly important, we also have to deliver the prime editing machine into the right cells. We have to test its safety and its efficacy in animal models. And so there's a lot of work that has to be done before prime editing can be directly applied to human patients, for example.
David, how would you characterize the very next step in this, given what you've accomplished so far? What's the very next thing you've got to research?
Yeah, so I hope that the researchers in the field now characterize the potential effects of prime editors in cells, try to maximize their compatibility with as many different types of cells as possible, and of course interface them with the various molecular delivery methods that will enable prime editing to work in live animals.
So that you're several steps away from the live animals part.
We're some number of steps away. We're working on using prime editing in live animals, but that will require some additional work. And we've made our constructs encoding all of the prime editing reagents available as of today. So any researcher can go to AdGene, the nonprofit company that is sort of the library of DNA blueprints, and get our prime editing constructs and try the research themselves.
So you've basically made it open source so that other people can be experimenting and doing research with it at the same time, simultaneously.
That's right. The goal is to allow these tools to be used by as many researchers as possible and not to try to keep them secret.
So, I want to step out of the realm of science and into the realm of society for a minute on this. We've talked on the show about CRISPR in the past. Part of that has included discussing the ethical implications. I absolutely get the potential of addressing what something like 89% of genetic diseases with this, with prime editing. At the same time, if I am understanding this correctly, this technology, it may allow you to pretty much insert any edit that you want into genetic code. So is there a moral hazard to be considered here as well, David?
Yeah, at this point, I'm very optimistic about the prospects of using prime editing to do good. As with any technology, genome editing, in theory, could be misused. But I think the barrier to using these tools is high enough that it remains much more practical to surmount those barriers for legitimate purposes. Of course, the scientific community and regulators must continue our efforts to ensure that all editing technologies are implemented in an ethical and responsible manner. And this thoughtful partnership, as you point out, will become increasingly important as genome editing technologies continue to advance in their capabilities and in their application scope.
I'm thinking, for example, of a case in 2017 where a self-titled biohacker named Josiah Zehner injected himself with CRISPR-edited genetic material live on stage at a conference and basically went on to sell a do-it-yourself at-home CRISPR kit. So I hear you that the threshold to for sort of nefarious uses or unethical uses is in many ways higher than the scientific advancements that are exciting and good for humanity. But how should we be thinking about the side-by-side evolution of regulations and ethical frameworks, et cetera, as technology in this area advances so quickly?
Right. I mean, to be clear, I strongly caution against do-it-yourself injection of prime editors or any kind of editing agent. I think such demonstrations and purported applications are irresponsible because they're much more likely to do harm to the individuals just from poor injection techniques, from not knowing exactly what you're injecting, and from not having the kinds of strict quality controls and safety checks that are needed to administer drugs through legitimate ways into patients. So I think as with any substance, one has to exercise a lot of careful judgment before just deciding to inject it into yourself. So I'm always horrified to hear that some people without proper training or without proper procedures are recommending to others that they inject materials into their bodies that have no such quality safeguards.
So, David, prime editing, you've made it, to use a layperson's term, sort of open source so that others can work with it. At the same time, you're co-founder of a number of biotech companies, including Editas Medicine, which is a pharmaceutical company which wants to treat diseases by using therapy based on gene editing technology. You've also got Pairwise Plants, which offers genome editing for agriculture. What will and are the tensions? Biotech is a multi-billion dollar industry. What are the tensions between open sourcing some of these technological advancements and proprietary advancements for profitability in single companies?
Right. That's a great question. It's important to emphasize that while we welcome researchers to use these technologies and try to make them as open source in that regard as possible, that the amount of capital needed to actually bring a new human therapeutic into patients is enormous, far beyond the resources of virtually any academic lab. And therefore, it's really necessary if patients are to benefit from these technologies to be able to provide them through paths towards industrialization.
So, I'm going to have to stop you there, David. I'm sorry. I appreciate that answer. That's David Liu, Richard Merkin Professor at the Broad Institute and a chemistry professor at Harvard. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, we're going to take your calls about filling out financial aid. I'm Tiziana Deering. There's more Radio Boston coming up. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. This week, WBUR's Edify team launched its series, Small Colleges, Big Challenges, which takes a look at how small private schools in New England are dealing with everything from financial woes to low enrollment to closures. In light of that, we wanted to take a look at the financial aid process, given that the 2020-2021 Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or FAFSA, rolled out this month. Experts stress that students and their families should file their FAFSAs as soon as possible, since financial aid in many states is awarded on a first-come, first-served basis. But it is not an easy process. So we've brought in two people familiar with the FAFSA to help us sift through it. Joining us now in Studio 3 is Rochelle Aranis, Director of Programs at Inversant, a nonprofit organization that helps send low-income students to college. Rochelle, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I should note that Bob Hildreth, the founder of Inversant, is a major donor to WBUR's Edify. Mm-hmm. Also with us is Peter Barros, Executive Director of La Vida Scholars, a nonprofit helping low-income, high-achieving students in Lynn. Peter, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Good afternoon.
We very much want you as part of this conversation as well. Parents, students, are you completing the FAFSA and or the CSS profile? Have you done it in the past? What questions do you have? Or what do you wish you'd known back when you did it. For those going through the college application process for the first time, what do you want to know about the financial aid or college application and admissions process that we might be able to help with today? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. All right, so Rochelle, the FAFSA opened this month, October 1st, kicking off one of the busiest times of the year for both of you, actually. Mm-hmm. What does that look like? Let's start with you, Rochelle, at Inversant. How do you prepare for that, and what are you working on now?
Yes, of course. So we have a curriculum that we develop and make sure that it's updated whenever financial aid rules change or requirements for families and parents. So October is one of our busy months because of the fact that this is when we launch programming with all of our families. So not only is it, you know, the opening of applying for financial aid for our senior families, but this is the first time that we see our families after an entire summer break. Basically. So we do a lot of preparation. We make sure that, you know, our curriculum is intact. So what we do is we hold workshops across all of our high school partnerships. And in addition to some of the organizations that we partner with, including La Vida, and we speak to families about the ins and outs of how to apply for financial aid. Why is it important for every single family to apply, regardless of income or misconceptions that families may have? So this is a really busy month. We actually finished all of our workshops. We have about 5 or 6 throughout the entire month that we do.
So, Peter, what kinds of questions and areas of angst are families coming in with? I'm assuming your work would be somewhat similar to what we're hearing from Rochelle. So what do families need?
Yeah, for some context, I did a FAFSA about an hour and a half ago. I had a family member come in at like 10 a.m., I mean, to be honest, before you even start the process, I think families are already anxious. Like, the process in and of itself just stresses families out, I think.
I did the FAFSA this month, and I was sick to my stomach the whole thing. Yeah.
No, I think, you know, especially for the families and students that we serve, right, they're first generation. This might, for them, they didn't handle it themselves, the family. So for most of my families, this is their first kid going off to college. They just feel confused and clueless. That's why the workshops are so important, to be able to introduce the, you know, show it to them, tell them what we're going to need. But I think the number one thing our families are just worried, am I going to get any money? Is my child going to be able to go to college? Or are we going to make a mistake? And I think that's why I advise the students to make sure, you know, they come to us first before we do the FAFSA, to not try to do it on your own.
Families shouldn't try to fill out the FAFSA alone if they have the option not to?
If there are resources out there, and there are a couple of resources, organizations that help families, even some of the high schools and some of the public school districts that we work with host kind of like a FAFSA day for their families to come in. So it's always good to have an expert there. But I would always recommend parent and student, if possible, to be there so that they can understand the ins and outs together.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What questions do you have about financial aid? Are you working on it with your own young adults right now? Have you worked on it in the past? Is there something you wish you knew that you think other people should? Do you know how to find resources to help you and your child at this important time? So there's this other thing. So it's not just FAFSA, right? We have alphabet letters all over the place. There's this other thing called the CSS profile, which, as I understand it, is administered by the College Board, not the federal government. It's a private nonprofit. How does it differ from FAFSA, and do families need to do both?
It depends on the student and the schools that they're applying to. CSS profile, for example, school like BU, I'm pretty sure, requires a CSS profile. In fact, I'm confident they do. It's mostly for some of the top-tier elite private colleges that requirement, because they want a deeper dive into the family's financial aid and their financial circumstances. And
I think it's something like 200 colleges and universities.
Go ahead.
And so, great example. That's a great point. I'm glad you're really bringing that up. I think people think that FAFSA is the financial aid process. I would actually argue that FAFSA is easier, the easiest part sometimes. And not all students end up having to do a CSS profile, but it's a lot. Like I think I've told people before, I think CSS profile makes students have to jump through a hoop on fire, blindfolded, backwards, because they really do ask for so many questions. You need to, and for some of our students and families, that means they're bringing, I mean, you need to sometimes, CSS requires you to disclose the non-custodial parent. And that can be really
tricky.
Meaning
if the parents are divorced or separated.
Yes. Yeah, okay. And for some families, that's pretty straightforward. You email a non-custodial parent. But for some of our families, right, that it becomes a traumatic process, like, to be quite frank. You know, suddenly we're talking about, you know, if a parent's in another country, if a parent's been is incarcerated, if a parent is deceased, and you need to provide documentation to explain that situation. But CSS in general asks everything that the FAFSA does, but then it'll ask, you know, how much your rent is, medical, dental expenses. Do you have other kids? How much are your expenses for those kids? Do you have a car? Do you rent? Like, it asks a lot of questions.
So, Rochelle, the first F in the acronym FAFSA stands mm-hmm. for free. Yes. People can fill it out for free. The CSS profile, I think it's $25 for the first one and $16 for every school after that. I think yes. the FAFSA allows you to automatically fill it out for 10 schools.
Exactly.
So is it advisable for any student who's applying to an institution that asks for both? Do you have to do either of them, and should you do them both?
Well, I mean, I think it depends on where the student is going to apply to. And I think a lot of universities and colleges do require it. So if a student, like Peter mentioned, were to apply to BU, for example, and BU requires the CSS profile for the child, they are going to have to fill out both the FAFSA and the CSS profile, which makes it, you know, very confusing for families, because we do tell them, you know, the major application that you have to fill out, it is free. But then when you get into college affordability, that's one of the things. Okay, so I have to pay for the application piece of applying to all of these colleges, and I have to pay also for the financial piece as well.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Lori from Concord, you're on the line. Go ahead, Lori. What's your question?
Yes, I'm wondering. My son is a sophomore, and he inherited some money from a grandparent who passed away last year. And I'm wondering if there's any thresholds in, you know, financial assets that would it even make sense to file FAFSAs? I mean, is there a point at which there's not a point in doing so?
Peter.
That's a great point. I think what the one good thing is that he's a sophomore, so you have some time to get ready for that. What I will say, FAFSA made a huge change a few years ago where they moved it to October 1st, right? Forever, it was on January 1st. So what I will say is you have a good amount of time, but by when you file your taxes, your child's junior year, that's going to be the end all.
So I think her child is a sophomore in college.
Oh, in college?
Yeah.
Oh,
is that right, Lori? Are you still there?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And your son is a sophomore in college now?
Yes.
Okay, oh, so okay. Lori still fill out the FAFSA for subsequent years?
I would say yes, yeah. Because the colleges do require it, and if I'm assuming he's getting some kind of financial aid from the institution, the expectation is exactly, you don't just fill out FAFSA once and you're done. You have to keep renewing it even when you go off to college. But yes, to her point, that income, she has to report her income and her assets, and he has to report his income and assets, and that could essentially affect the calculation, the expected family contribution. That's what FAFSA. Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead, Rochelle.
What I would add to that, too, and Peter talked a little bit about it, too, is there's a lot of colleges and universities that to continue to provide you with sometimes even merit aid, they do require the families to fill out the FAFSA. So we do have a lot of families that are in the middle class, for example, income bracket, who ask that question, is it even worth it for me to do it? And we say, yes, there's a lot of universities that do require and won't even give you some types of financial aid if you don't actually do the FAFSA.
So keep the conversation going. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Helen from Marblehead, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'm just calling in as a mom who's been through this process with two daughters who are now in their 30s, that remind parents that the money that they're getting for financial aid is usually the bulk of it is in a loan, and that these loans have to be repaid by the students once they graduate. And that can be really cumbersome to young people starting out their new lives just wanted to remind everybody to really think hard about where you send your child to school as far as what kind of debt they be incurring.
That's really helpful, Helen. And Peter and Rochelle, not all financial aid is created equal, right? Mm-hmm. That you may still take on significant financial burdens even if you receive aid. So how do you talk to families who come, let's say, to La Vida Scholars about how to grope their way through that decision-making process?
Well, I mean, it all comes down to whether it's need-based aid or merit-based aid. And I think every family and student's different. And students and families, well, depend on the institution and how much you're going to get. I think at La Vida Scholars, we're working with our students to target the colleges that give the most generous need-based aid, colleges that meet 100% need. BU, for example, this year for the first time ever, is going to be meeting 100% need.
But that won't all be grants, right? That will be grants and loans?
And so all students get offered the $5,500 loan by the federal government. So students are offered that. Across the board, that's pretty
just
consistent.
Okay.
Some colleges like BU or these colleges that meet 100% need, they might have the student only take out 2,000 or 3,000 of that. But that's a very small percentage of colleges that have that policy. That's strategically what we do. I think to a point you made earlier, right? I think middle class families, they are the ones that tend to get, to be quite frank, screwed over the most because mm-hmm. they're not low income enough to qualify for some of the great need based aid, but they're not wealthy enough to have $20,000 per year to contribute to college.
Okay, let's take another call. We've got Elizabeth from Westwood on the line. Elizabeth, go ahead.
I am recently widowed, applying for financial aid. Thank you for my oldest child, who is a senior in high school. My husband was the primary breadwinner. I do work, but make significantly less income than he did. I did receive a life insurance benefit, a one-time life insurance benefit. And just wondering if, that will be sitting in my bank account as an asset, obviously. And some of it was intended for college tuition, of course. But will I expect to just lose that, completely to college tuition?
Rochelle, what's your answer? What do you think for Elizabeth?
I would say we do have a lot of families that have unexpected circumstances happen. And one of the things that we tell families is even though you fill out FAFSA once a year, there is an appeal process, for example, that can happen where families can update the financial aid system. Something happened in family. I lost an income. This is what's going on. But in addition to that, yes, that's any sort of income that comes in or is lost is something that needs to be reported.
Isn't there a place in either form to explain extraordinary circumstances or your family's circumstances, Peter?
So funny enough, FAFSA doesn't really give you a section to do that. CSS Profile does. And again, that's only for a few select colleges. But I think to the caller's point, remember the FAFSA is about getting your financial aid from the federal government. Mm-hmm. And then that in Massachusetts, that also goes to the state to get state funding. Every college receives your expected family contribution, your FAFSA, and they make their own individual determination of how much they're going to give you, right? So a school like Harvard that has a super large endowment, they might be okay with it and be like, okay, we're still going to give you $40,000, right? Another college might be like, we're only going to give you $15,000. And so I think down the road, what we do with our students is come April, March, when the financial aid packages start coming in, right? That's when you can appeal directly to the college. But I wouldn't wait till then. I would reach out to the colleges as you're submitting your financial aid and let them know this mm-hmm. is the circumstances, right? This is in some colleges, again, back in the day, colleges used to ask for a copy of your taxes. Like they wanted you to bring it in and submit a physical copy. So it depends by college, honestly, by college. Mm-hmm. So my advice to her would be to reach out to the colleges she's applying, to give them a heads up, so that she can provide those extenuating circumstances.
And Elizabeth, does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much.
You're welcome. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's take another call. Maureen from Dedham, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good, Maureen.
Good afternoon.
The point I was calling to make is really just a reminder that even after you fill out the FAFSA, or even, whatever extra loans you take, that there's always a fee that the college is going to charge you, and they'll put your student on hold in terms of, getting their classes until that fee is paid. And just being a parent that's been through this with two students, those are things you don't know. And you think you've completed everything and you've got all your ducks in a row. And next thing you know, your child's calling you saying, I can't sign up for classes. I'm on hold. So those are just important little tidbits, you know, that you do not know until you've been through it.
Excellent. Thanks, Maureen. Thanks. So, Rochelle, how do you work with families about hidden costs and fee waivers? And, you know, the College Board, and maybe we'll have time to get into this, they charge you for everything. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. how do you help families through that and not both get caught by surprise or not apply to schools that they want to or should because of the cost of applying?
Yes, of course. I think for us, we go over the different types of colleges and universities that are out there. And sometimes we get really to the nitty-gritty. For example, Salem State University, this is what an award letter looks like for Salem State, where they're supposed to list all of the costs. We talk to families about the fact that some of the costs that may be listed in that award letter may not be 100% transparent also. So sometimes we even send them, say, hey, the university's website is really, really helpful when it comes to this. Sometimes the cost that you see in the award letter may not necessarily reflect that for the year that you're thinking of. So we always send families to the university website to check out that. And we're honest with them and tell them about the fact that there are a lot of hidden costs and a lot of indirect costs that are not necessarily just the tuition, the room and board that you're going to be thinking. Even thinking about transportation, for example, if your child is going to be going to California, for example, for a university, thinking about a plane ticket, that's something that families sometimes don't really associate with the total cost of college. So we kind of go over the entire spectrum of everything that you need to think about when you're comparing how much a college or a university is going to cost you.
Peter, at the same time, what if the plane ticket to California is expensive, but you get a better package in some other ways? How should families think about things like being close to home or an in-state tuition versus a private tuition? It's not always obvious. How do you guide families through that?
Well, I think one of the things is, again, you're going to get the award letter once you're accepted to the college in the spring. And unfortunately, there is no universal award letter, and some colleges are really upfront and it's easy to understand. And then some colleges, it can be a little misleading, right? Some colleges will include a $2,000-$3,000 work-study job as part of the financial aid package. I don't like to count that. And I tell students and I tell families, because your child hasn't earned that money yet, right? Like when it's time to pay the bill before the child starts in September, do you have the $3,000? No, they got to actually go work and earn
it. Interesting.
So I find that misleading. So that's we're able to help our students do that. I've given colleges that feedback that, you know, please don't do that. And then the big difference is, right, the direct costs versus the indirect costs. The reality is, you know, the analogy I'll say sometimes to the kids is, right, you got to if you have a home, you got to pay for the mortgage, you got to pay for the electricity, you got to pay for the water. Right. You cannot. But the Wi-Fi, the cable, the right. Those are kind of like optional things. Like you'll be able to live without those. So the direct costs are the tuition, fees, room and board. In the case of living on campus, you have to pay those. The indirect costs are transportation, books, all these other things. And colleges like to just estimate that sometimes, but listen, kids have gotten even more creative in terms of books, right, and transportation. And those are the costs that you can manage little by little. So I think it's important to understand the cost that you actually have to pay and then really understanding your aid. Again, and another great point, right, the loans, the fact that they are sometimes just thrown in. So many kids come to me with a financial aid award letter that says, look, I only got to pay $2,000 to go to this college, and there's a $14,000 Parent PLUS loan thrown in as part of the package, which technically the parent still has to apply and be approved for. It's not a given they're going
to
get it.
Oh, so Rochelle, to build on that, so they may even tell you about loans that you don't necessarily even have yet.
Mm-hmm, exactly, yes.
So what happens if a family applies for that loan and doesn't get it?
So for the most part, it depends on what kind of loan. So Parent PLUS loans are very lenient in terms of their requirements, and that actually makes it a little confusing for families because they think that this is a good loan. This is a student loan. This is something that probably has a low interest rate. But I would say Parent PLUS loans are one of the most predatory loans that are out there because of the fact that there's absolutely no sometimes there's no limit onto how much. So a parent can probably borrow $40,000-$50,000 in 1 year of their kid's college career and end up owing that much money. We've seen and I've heard of a lot of families that are going into retirement age with a good chunk of parent PROS loans. So that's one of those things that also makes it very confusing.
Now, we had one more caller we're not going to have time for, but I did want to note that he works in higher ed and had called in to say, listen, you can also rely on the college financial aid offices. You can call and ask for help, and they'll provide help as well. All right, so we need our fast tips. Peter, if you were going to give one fast tip to families, what is it?
Oof, wow, put on the spot. I mean, you know, sometimes I feel like I'm an accountant because I'm helping families guide through this financial aid process. So, I mean, one piece of advice is that before you get to senior year and junior year, make sure you are meeting with your own accountant when you're doing your own taxes to make sure you can line things up correctly there. Sometimes, you know, let's be honest, I meet with all kinds of situations, families where one mom is claiming they're separated, one's claiming two kids, one is claiming zero. And sometimes you got to be careful with how you do that.
All right, Rochelle, what's your quick fast tip?
I would say start talking to your kids pretty early in terms of what their hopes and dreams are when it comes to the process so that the family is kind of like on the similar page at the very beginning and you can start looking at the different types of higher education, options that are out there.
Okay, Rochelle Aranese is the Director of Programs at Inversant. Thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
And Peter Bottos, Executive Director of La Vida Scholars, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And listeners, I just want to take a moment to let you know that tomorrow, Tuesday, Radio Boston will be hosting a special live 90-minute debate with all 8 of the Boston City Council at-large candidates. It will be at WBUR City Space. We'll ask the candidates about the biggest issues facing the city of Boston, affordable housing, education, the opioid crisis. It's part of our coverage this political season. It's produced as part of WBUR's longstanding partnership with the Boston Globe and the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston. The debate will air live right here on 90.9 WBUR at 2:30 tomorrow. We'll stream it online. Radio Boston will be a key host. But we'd actually love for you to join us at WBUR City Space. So for information on getting free tickets and actually coming in to attend, you can go to wbur.org/events. Stay with us. Coming up, we will speak to an author who discovered poetry in prison. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering. Reginald Dwayne Betts says he discovered poetry in solitary confinement. Betts was convicted for using a pistol to carjack a man when he was 16 years old. He was sentenced as an adult and served more than 8 years in an adult prison. After release, Betts earned degrees from Prince George Community College, the University of Maryland, Warren Wilson College, and Yale Law School. He was appointed by President Obama to the Coordinating Council of the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, and his writing has won numerous awards, including a National Magazine Award in 2018. His new collection of poems is called Felon. He lives in New Haven with his and was in town this week for the Boston Book Festival. Dwayne Betts, thanks for being with us on Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thanks. Appreciate Sorry about that cough at the beginning there.
Oh, no, I cough all the time.
Excellent. So, Dwayne, can you tell us about the moment you discovered poetry?
It might be better put to say the moment poetry discovered me, but I was in solitary confinement for, I guess, maybe the second or third time. And in the hole, you couldn't request books, and so we had sort of a system in which we just passed each other the books that we had. We passed it on. So if somebody shouted, somebody have a book, and they wouldn't name a specific kind of book. They just asked for a book. And whoever was closest to them that would have a book, they would just send it to them. So I called for a book, and I had been there for maybe 3 or 4 months, and I asked for a book. And somebody just slid this anthology, this poetry anthology to me. It was Dudley Randall's Black Poets. And it sort of profoundly changed my life, introduced me to the poetry of Etheridge Knight, Lucille Clifton, Nikki Giovanni. But sort of more importantly, the poems helped me see that in a space of 14 lines or 20 lines or 30 lines, you could communicate what people tried to say in a whole novel, you know, in a whole 30-page essay, 15-page essay. And that I like the idea that in a minute and a half, I could try to tell everybody what mattered for that moment.
So when did you first try it? Do you remember when you wrote your first poem?
Yeah, it would have been the same night. You know, like I read the book, it would have been, I read for Freckleface Gerald, you know, Etheridge Knight had did time in prison. And so part of becoming anything is seeing somebody who you could see your own reflection in doing it. And Etheridge Knight has served time in prison, and he had became a poet, and he had became a published poet while incarcerated. And so that same night, I know that I scribbled something.
This new collection of poetry, it's about the emotional trauma of prison. It is greatly varied in the length of the poems and the style of the poems, but there is a strong voice that, you know, I think penetrates all the way through. You talk about the wounds that people who are incarcerated carry with them even when they're out. I'd love to ask you to read one of the poems from the book. It's one of four poems that are called Essay on Reentry. Would you read that for us?
Definitely. Essay on Reentry. At 2 a.m., without enough spirit spilling into my liver to know to keep my mouth shut, my youngest learned of years I spent inside a box. A spell, a kind of incantation I was under. Not whiskey, but history. I robbed a man. This, months before, my son would drop bucket after bucket on opposing players. The entire bedraggled bunch 5 and 6, and he leaping as if every layup erases something. That's how I saw it. My screaming, coaching, sweating presence recompense for the pen. My father ain't never seen me play ball as part of this. My oldest son knew, told of my crimes by a stranger. Tell me we aren't running towards failure is what I want to ask my sons. But it is 2 a.m. The oldest has gone off to dream in the comfort of his room. The youngest, despite him seeming more lucid than me, just reflects cartoons back from his eyes. So when he tells me, Daddy, it's okay, I know what's happening to some scraggling angel, lost from his pack, finding a way to fulfill his duty. Lending words to this kid who crawls into my arms, wanting more than stories of my prison. The sleep that he fought while I held court at a bar with men who knew that when the drinking was done, the drinking wouldn't make the stories we brought home any easier to tell.
Thank you. If I can ask, you have 2 sons, is that right?
Yes.
How do you talk to your sons about prison?
I think I talk to them. I mean, I've learned that I talk to them the way we have to talk to our children about anything. I'm honest. I'm upright. It's complicated. Sometimes I'm sad. I feel like sometimes we aren't able to have this wide range of emotions. We aren't able to tap into what it means to have regrets. And we talk to our children as if we have all of the answers. And sometimes I talk to them and I find myself just admitting that I don't have enough of the answers, let alone all of the answers.
Does it bother you to admit that?
Maybe it did before, but I think I know one of the things that learning to be a parent has been meant for me is learning when whatever I was, whatever I am, is not this body of perfection that my children need. You know, it's just me. And you get that when your child is up at, you know, 2 a.m. and you're frustrated and you just don't know what to do to keep him from crying. And you call in those days because you figured it out. You know, I figured it out then when I didn't have enough, when I hadn't done it before, when I couldn't call on, you know, a family member to come help, when, you know, my wife might have been asleep and she needed to sleep, or when I might have been asleep because I needed to sleep and she had to figure it out. You know, you learn that you are enough, even if that enough isn't everything.
I can't imagine a parent in the world listening to this who doesn't profoundly identify with what you just said. I noted that there are several poems in the book with that same title, Essay on Reentry. Why did you do that, and what were you working towards with 4 different poems all with that same title?
You know, I think we sort of circumscribe what it means to be incarcerated in such a way that we imagine that the felon is some unique person, that the person who has a criminal conviction is some unique person. And by doing that, it makes it far easier to discriminate against them. But by titling a bunch of poems, Essay on Reentry, I was trying to cover the sort of expansiveness of the experience. I think that people should be able to relate to the poem I just read, even if it isn't prison that they're telling their child about. It could be anything. It could be anything. And you asking your child to give you something that children just aren't required to give us, which is solace, you know, which is like providing the answers that we need from them when sometimes they just need a hug. And then there's other poems that sort of essay on reentry poems that talk about what it means to have reconnected with somebody who the speaker have victimized, right? It means, what does it mean to talk to a person who you hurt and have them remind you of that hurt in a way that is challenging to you? It's poems about the collateral consequences. And so the point is that it's just not one version of coming home. The essay on reentry is trying to remind people that it's multiple iterations of what it means to come home. And they just, sadly, never stop. You know, I'll probably be 50, 60 years old, still contemplating what it means to be free.
Duane, a minute ago you used the word challenging. There are four other poems in the book that you call redacted or redaction poems. And I found them incredibly challenging. They appear on the page. They look like a redacted legal document on the page of the book with big black lines blocking out much of the text. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got the idea of these redaction poems?
I should say you are absolutely correct. They are redacted legal documents.
So those are real legal documents.
Yeah, those are real legal documents.
That was one of the things I was wondering when I read them.
Are you a lawyer?
No, I'm not. But they looked like people... stuff out of Ferguson, out of the Ferguson report.
Yeah. So you sound like a lawyer right now. which everybody listening will say, oh, man, all I need to do is say that to sound like a lawyer. So what happened was, it's an organization called the Civil Rights Corps. And they filed lawsuits against, like, the city of Montgomery, the city of Ferguson, and the city of Houston. And those lawsuits were because those cities were having practices in which they incarcerated people for their inability to pay bail or to pay small fines. But the thing is, if you want to read one of these civil suits, and the civil suit is at bottom the way a citizen can say, listen, I'm being mistreated by the system, court system, do something to stop me from being mistreated. These lawsuits are 70 pages long. They're filled with all kind of complicated minutiae, things about jurisdiction, all references to other law cases, and nobody is really going to read that 70-page lawsuit. But this, to me, the lawsuit itself is like one of the sort of symbols of democracy. It is our way to have voice in a system that's supposed to correct error. But what does it mean if nobody could understand the way that the system does that? What does it mean if nobody will read one of these complaints? So what I wanted to do was turn a 70-page complaint into a 4-page poem, a 5-page poem, a 10-page poem. And a redaction, instead of being redacting the things that are supposed to be confidential above our pay grade, I wanted to say, no, I'm redacting what's superfluous. And so when that 70-page poem, that 70-page legal brief, that 70-page complaint becomes a 4-page poem, I'm saying that this is the heart of it. This is what actually matters.
We only have about 2 minutes left, but I really want listeners to hear this. Could you read just the first section of In Alabama for us?
In Alabama versus the city of Montgomery. The plaintiffs, impoverished, jailed by the city, unable to pay traffic tickets, pay or sit in jail. $50 per day. Plaintiffs unable to pay. Each sent to jail, told they could work off debts, $25 per day, cleaning the city, scrubbing feces and blood from jail floors.
What's striking is that the story isn't what's behind the black lines. The story is what's left after you use the black lines.
Yeah, it's astonishing that these things were going on when you read the poem. Somebody asked me if I made this up. And these lawsuits, they were all won. You know, the judge in these suits found that the practice were unconstitutional. So these were actually real cases in which the plaintiffs, the people who said that they were harmed, they won. And so when people say, I can't believe that this is happening, what I ask myself is, how much of what happens in the criminal justice system happens under our names and we are fundamentally unaware of?
Duane, we've got about a minute left. These poems cost a person in reading them. What does it cost you to write your poetry?
Oh, man, I got a minute.
Sorry.
I don't know. I think I know every week I get phone calls from people doing life in prison. So I'm not sure what it costs me, but I know what it cost them to still be serving out their prison sentences. And I hope some of the poetry and some of the advocacy and some of the legal work I do could get somebody free.
Dwayne Betts is an award-winning writer and poet. His new collection is called Felon. Dwayne, I just really appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tisiana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.